Politicians often hope political coattails can boost their chances. Now it appears Republicans are trying to cut them off as fast as possible. The story today on the Texas Standard.
Texas Standard is a production of KUT Austin, KERA North Texas, Houston Public Media, and Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I'm David Brown. We'll hear why John Cornyn's trying to distance himself from the White House and what it may reveal about how the GOP sees its chances for November. Also, Governor Abbott concerned, too, digging into his own political pocketbook to back Texas Republicans down ballot. Cutting the cord involuntarily. Pandemic protections against utility disconnections slip away, leaving many in danger. And you've heard of the sleeping giant in Texas politics? Maybe time to put the metaphor to rest. Those stories and a whole lot more when the Texas Standard gets underway right after this. No matter where you are, it's Texas Standard time on this 20th day of October, 2020. I'm David Brown. Great to have you with us. Quick reality check. What was the first thing you did this morning? Anyone else reach for their smartphone? If so, you might have seen the same story that knocked my socks off this morning. The New York Times reporting that Google, the tech giant behind much of what has made the online world what it is today, to be formally charged as an illegal monopoly. It is easily the biggest move against a company of its kind in generations, and given the size of Google, could well wind up being on the scale of epic antitrust fights of the past, with enormous implications for Texas as we know it today. The changes wrought by the bust-up of Standard Oil in no small part created the backdrop for Houston as an energy capital, and there's no denying AT&T would not be the Dallas company it is today were it not for Ma Bell's breakup. But a monopoly fight with Google could involve Texas more directly. Texas Attorney General Ken Paxton, you may recall, is leading a multi-state effort by attorneys general nationwide investigating Google for monopolistic activities. We'll continue to track the implications here at the Standard. Hard to separate out some of the politics at work in the background, but it's becoming clear that when it comes to President Trump and his fellow Republicans in this election season, some are trying to distance themselves from the White House. To explore that issue a bit further, we're joined now by Mark P. Jones, fellow in political science at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. Mark, welcome back.
Oh, thanks for having me on.
It's my understanding that John Cornyn has come out saying that he's been privately disagreeing with the president. Have you heard about this?
Yes. Senator Cornyn has tried to send a signal, especially to many Republicans in Texas, that he has disagreed with the president, but he's done so privately because he's felt that's the most productive way to still get things done and not incur the president's wrath.
When we talk about private disagreements, these are rather public issues that he apparently has been pushing, he says he's been pushing back against the president on. We're talking about issues like what? The deficit and the border wall?
Oh, right. And so they're very serious issues. I think what Senator Cornyn is trying to signal to Texas voters and perhaps voters nationally is that he felt it was more constructive for him to work with the president rather than to publicly disagree with him, effectively telling us that President Trump's not someone whose mind you can easily change, if change at all, and therefore you have to work with him if you want to get something done. I think there are two things that are going on here. One is a short-term focus by people with election fights like Senator Cornyn or Senator Martha McSally out in Arizona, and they're trying to peel off maybe 5 or 6% of Republican voters who normally vote Republican and would guarantee them a majority and win a victory, but are so anti-Trump that they feel, Senator Cornyn and Senator McSally feel, that if they don't essentially distance themselves from the president, they could actually lose, and those voters could, after they vote for Joe Biden, continue down to the Senate race and also vote Democratic.
How much of this is about Cornyn and other Republicans protecting themselves as opposed to really the coattail effect? And in Texas, of course, that coattail effect may be somewhat weakened by the fact that we don't have straight ticket balloting anymore here in the Lone Star State.
Well, and that's the short-term effect. That is where they're really trying to protect themselves from the negative down-ballot effects of Donald Trump being at the top of the ticket. And we know that Donald Trump is the worst thing that's happened to the Texas Republican Party in the modern era, and that he's a real drag on the ticket. I think there's also something that's going on here, though, is Senator Cornyn, Senator Ben Sasse up in Nebraska, who isn't in any real re-election fight, and other Republicans realize that President Trump is most likely going to lose. And they're laying the groundwork for the post-Trump era, where they're going to try to distance themselves from Donald Trump and his unpopular policies. And one way to do that is to get the ball rolling before he loses so that they can say, no, I was saying that before Donald Trump was lost, rather than afterwards when people will say, well, now he's lost and now you feel free to speak your mind. You didn't do that, though, when he was still president. So while it's late, I think what Senator Cornyn and Senator Sasse would say is, well, we did acknowledge our differences with the president, although it is quite late.
I was going to say, yeah, it is interesting the timing of Cornyn and other fellow Republicans coming out saying they're at odds with Trump over certain things, especially since part of the narrative has been that Republicans in Washington have been Trump enablers, to use the terminology of many of Trump's opponents. Do you think that this has the potential to backfire?
Well, if it's going to backfire in the short term, for Senator Cornyn, as well as, say, Senator McSally out in Arizona, it would be with Trump supporters becoming disgusted with Senator Cornyn, and therefore, after they cast their vote for President Trump at the top of the ticket, they skip their next race of senator. I don't think they'd be voting for MJ Hager, but they may vote for Kerry McKinnon, the Libertarian candidate. So that's the one danger that Cornyn faces, is by distancing himself from Trump right now in a bid to appeal to moderate Republicans who are voting for Joe Biden but may vote Republican on the rest of the ticket. He runs the risk of alienating diehard Trump supporters who may pass him over. It's a risk, although clearly the senator thinks it's one that's worth taking. Although I think it is important to note that Senator Cornyn's criticism of President Trump is much more muted than that of, say, Senator Sasse up in Nebraska, who was quite critical of the president.
Mark P. Jones is fellow in political science at Rice University's Baker Institute for Public Policy. Mark, thanks again.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
With political insiders around the country paying attention to what's happening politically in the Lone Star State, Governor Greg Abbott is focused on something rather particular, specifically keeping Republicans in the majority in the Texas House and making voters aware of judicial races on the ballot. His campaign gave some of the details to the Texas Tribune, where Patrick Svitek is political reporter, and he joins us now. Patrick, welcome back to The Standard.
Thanks for having me on.
So Governor Greg Abbott is dipping into his own, what, campaign coffers? And how much money are we talking about here?
Yeah, so his campaign account has always had a lot of money in it. He's known as a pretty strong fundraiser. As of June, there was close to, I think, $38 million in that campaign account. So he certainly has the money to spend, and he's using it in the home stretch of this general election to help in the fight to defend the Republican majority in the state house, and also to spread the word about judicial races, which are more important than ever, given that this is the first election in Texas without straight ticket voting. And so there's some anxiety on both sides about whether voters, especially in some of these big counties, are going to go all the way down the ballot, some of these very long ballots, and, you know, check off the box in some of these more obscure, lesser known races, including the judicial races. And so Abbott's campaign told us that they're spending in the mid seven figures on this effort, again, that is focused on both the state house and these judicial races.
What are the stakes as the governor sees it? Currently, what, Democrats 9 seats short of being in the majority in the House? Is that right?
That is correct. And somewhat remarkably for our story, the governor's top political strategist, Dave Carney, told us that he sees, quote, zero chance that Democrats flip the House. Not a lot of people share that view exactly. Democrats are feeling pretty confident, and some other Republicans concede that they certainly have a path to the majority. As you pointed out, they're 9 seats away from the majority. They do have to defend the 12 seats they picked up in 2018. They believe that they're in a pretty good position to return most, if not all, of those freshmen. But it's a real battle. I mean, there's as many as 22 seats that they think that Democrats think are in play that they could flip. As we pointed out, they only need to pick up 9. So they're working with a pretty wide battlefield, and there's also a lot of money pouring in on their side, even as you have, Republican money in the form of Greg Abbott's campaign account coming into play like this.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. You're reporting a National Democratic Super PAC is now putting more money into this Texas House battle. What is the latest there, and how much money is coming in?
Yeah, this group, Forward Majority, had announced in about, I think it was early September, that they would be spending over $6 million in the fight for the state House majority. They announced this morning that they're going to be doubling that. And so they'll be spending over $12 million. And they said that that was in response to kind of recently observing, you know, Republican spending really ramping up in some of these targeted races. And it was a reaction to that. And so, you know, it just goes to show just how fiercely competitive that this fight for the state House majority has become.
Well, at least we know one winner, the media companies, because this money essentially ends up going into ad campaigns, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about.
Right. A lot of this money is going toward TV ads. And, you know, it should be noted that a lot of these targeted races are in the cities or suburbs of places like Dallas and Houston, which especially at this point in the election cycle, if you're buying ad time, are not cheap places. And so it does take a lot of money to get up on TV there in a very serious way. I should also note that, you know, some of this money, particularly the money that Abbott's campaign is spending, is going toward digital ads and very targeted digital ads. You know, for example, Abbott's campaign, you know, is they're looking at 24 districts and then they're attacking, they're airing attack ads, digital attack ads against Democrats on four different issues in each of those, you know, 24 districts. And so there's basically 96 unique digital ads that they may be serving up to a voter, you know, at any given moment in those across those 24 districts. And so it's a really targeted effort. And, you know, it goes to show it's not just TV where the battle is playing out.
Patrick Svitek is political reporter at the Texas Tribune. We'll link to their latest at texasstandard.org. Patrick, thanks again.
Thanks for having me.
Wells Dunbar is monitoring the talk of Texas on this Tuesday. Hello there, Wells.
Howdy, David. We're hearing from folks about that story at the top of the show. John Cornyn attempting to distance himself from Donald Trump by saying he did disagree with the president, although he kept those disagreements private. Lots of reaction to this one. One of the top-ranked comments on the Texas Standard Facebook page addressed to Senator Cornyn himself, Bill Holston, writes, "You are a powerful U.S. senator. If you lack the courage to speak publicly, why do you serve in Congress?" Also, via Facebook, Charlene Hillman Abram addresses another tenet of Cornyn's tenure. She says, "Let's address his failure to criticize Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. Cornyn should have been working to help people strapped by the economic consequences of the coronavirus. He should have been pressuring McConnell and other Republicans for another stimulus package, and soon. Instead, we got nothing." Just a couple of the reactions to this developing a political story ahead of Election Day. And just one story we're watching. I'll be back with more reactions from social media later in the show.
We'd love to hear from you, Texas. You know what to do. Look for Texas Standard on your social media platform of choice. Wells Dunbar back in 35 with more of the Talk of Texas.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas Oncology, with a reminder that October is Breast Cancer Awareness Month. To aid early detection, all women over the age of 40 should undergo routine screening, like yearly mammograms. More at TexasOncology.com. Support for Texas Standard comes from Texas CASA, advocating for a safe and positive future for all Texas children in the child protection system. Volunteer information at BecomeACASA.org. Every child has a chance. It's you.
This is the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. There's never been a good time to have your utilities cut off. The pandemic might be a particularly bad one, however, not to mention hazardous to public health, which is why utility companies suspended cutoffs at the start of the COVID-19 outbreak. But now many of those protections are ending, leaving some Texans in danger of losing electricity, water, or gas. The Texas Standard's Michael Marks has more.
On March 26, the Texas Public Utilities Commission took a rare step. As the pandemic led to an economic crisis, the three-member board decided to temporarily suspend cutoffs of all the electric companies it regulates, which isn't all of them in Texas, but quite a few.
And the idea was to provide protection from disconnection for non-payment for Texas households that were at greatest risk as a result of the pandemic.
That's Andrew Barlow, spokesperson for the Utilities Commission. So even if you couldn't pay your bill, your lights would stay on. Similar rules were put in place for the water companies the commission regulates. The order was good for 6 months. The commission claims it protected over 600,000 households from losing electricity, particularly important during the summer months. But now, those protections are gone. The program was always designed to be temporary, Barlow said. The utility commission decided to wind it down after seeing progress in the state's unemployment rate.
As the job numbers have continued to recover, that was an indicator that the program had existed for the appropriate period of time from an economic perspective.
Texas's unemployment rate peaked in April at 13.5%. It had been going down since then, although the newest data shows it going up again. The rate rose by 1.5 percentage points from August to September. Barlow said that while there are currently no plans to reinstate the relief program, it could happen if more lockdowns are necessary. At the moment, though, many water and electric companies are back to business as usual, which means potential cutoffs for non-payment. Ezra Kerr is the utility collections billing manager for the city of Wichita Falls, which resumed cutting off water service for non-payment in July.
We left notices on people's doors saying, guys, this is coming. This is what's going to happen. We set up payment arrangements for people. It was kind of one of those things. At some point, everybody has to get back to normal operating procedure.
Kerr said that so far, there haven't been as many disconnections as she expected. Many customers took advantage of payment plans or reached out to one of the local nonprofits that helps people with their bills.
The agencies in town have been a huge help, not just water bills. They assist with all utilities, including rent and things along that line. So the fact that agencies are there really has been a saving grace for a lot of people.
There's only so far those agencies can go, though, having been stretched thin themselves during the pandemic. For the Texas Standard, I'm Michael Marks.
Support for coverage of business comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' comp provider, proud to be on the job with essential workers who are out there working safe and keeping Texas strong. More at texasmutual.com/onthejob.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Since we've been talking about a return to utility disconnections, what resources are out there to help those in need keep their water, lights, and gas running? For that, we're going to bring in Dana Harmon. She is the executive director of the Texas Energy and Poverty Research Institute. Dana, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you for having me, David.
Since we're talking about the Public Utility Commission ending its electricity relief program and that sort of thing, we should also talk about who's most likely to be affected. What is the relationship between poverty and growing energy costs here in Texas? And what about populations perhaps disproportionately affected?
Well, the pandemic is increasing energy insecurity, which is the ability to inadequately meet basic household needs for heating, cooling, and energy over time. Household access to energy is central to maintaining health and well-being. And even before the pandemic, 1 in 3 U.S. households was reporting difficulty paying their energy bills. And the problem really reflects a confluence of three factors. The first is lack of access to economic resources. The second is inefficient housing and appliance. And the third is really coping strategies that can lead to trade-offs, such as having to choose between paying energy bills and putting food on the table.
But that was one of the reasons that so many pandemic protections from disconnection were put into place when the pandemic was here. What you're describing is a situation that existed prior to the pandemic and one that we appear to be returning to. Should we be rethinking the way energy markets work in the state to avoid cutoffs, or is this just part of modern reality?
Well, what the pandemic is showing us is that households with high energy burdens are more likely to get caught in cycles of poverty. High energy burdens are associated with inadequate housing conditions and affect physical and mental health, nutrition, and local economic development. In fact, new research coming to us this month from the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy found that Black, Hispanic, Native American, and older adult households, as well as those families residing in low-income multifamily housing or manufactured housing, are all disproportionately affected by high energy burdens nationally, regionally, and in our metro areas. I think the pandemic is helping us to understand, see those inequities play out, and we really have to work to address those inequities in our system.
What we're talking about here are larger systemic issues and how these issues can affect things like a sense of well-being, mental health, that sort of thing. But on a day-to-day basis, I'm thinking about young people who are reliant upon computers and internet access, to say nothing of electricity, just to get an education in the current pandemic period. Could you talk a little bit more about those practical day-to-day things, struggles that people may be facing at an increasing rate now?
Absolutely. Energy assistance is often one of the first and biggest needs families have when the economy takes a sudden downturn. But you're right, it's often one of those things that we don't think about. But as more and more people are staying home, one of the things that we're seeing is energy consumption is continuing to rise. At the same time, a lot of families are affected by economic insecurity.
So what resources exist to help people who may be on the brink here?
Well, there was a program called the Electricity Relief Program, which ran from March through the end of September. These are folks who were receiving financial assistance and otherwise would have been disconnected, and it's representing about 3% of all retail electric customers in Texas. Now that the program has ended, there is also available a federal program called the Low Income Home Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP, that helps families pay gas and electric bills in all 254 counties in Texas. Community action agencies and a handful of other nonprofit organizations and governmental agencies distribute those funds directly to utilities on behalf of eligible customers.
So you have to apply to the utility and make a showing of need?
Well, agencies will help customers or clients through that process. And the easiest way to find the local agency that can help is by calling 211 or going to 211texas.org. But you're right. Also, many utilities and retail electric providers also offer assistance programs and will often work with their customers to help make deferred payment arrangements. So we do recommend folks reach out to their electricity and gas providers because especially now they do seem to be willing to work with customers to help them keep the lights on.
We'll have a link to more resources over at texasstandard.org. Dana Harmon is the executive director of the Texas Energy and Poverty Research Institute. Thanks so much for speaking with us on The Standard.
Thanks for having me.
Support for Texas Standard comes from TCU. Stories of Horned Frog changemakers like Amiso George, who is helping organizations navigate COVID-19 crisis communications, can be found at tcu.edu/teamwork.
From the Texas Newsroom, I'm Joseph Leahy. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals is blocking a lower court ruling that required election officials notify voters if there is a signature mismatch on their mail-in ballot. KUT's Ashley Lopez reports the decision Monday also means it won't be required that voters have a chance to fix the issue.
A lower federal court in Texas ruled last month that it's unconstitutional for election officials to reject a ballot based on what they consider to be a signature mismatch without letting a voter know and giving them a meaningful opportunity to correct the issue. In Texas, the signature on a mail-in ballot has to match the signature provided on an application for a ballot in order to be counted. Voting rights groups have argued methods for checking signatures vary by county, which means some voters are treated differently depending where they live. However, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals said in its ruling that Texas's strong interest in safeguarding the integrity of its elections from voter fraud far outweighs any burden the state's voting procedures place on the right to vote. There is currently no evidence of widespread mail-in ballot fraud in the U.S. or Texas. I'm Ashley Lopez in Austin.
Health officials say the earliest most Texans will be able to get vaccinated for COVID-19 is next July. Imelda Garcia is with the Texas Department of State Health Services. She outlined on Monday three groups that will be first in line for a vaccine: frontline workers, vulnerable populations, and people at increased risk of acquiring or transmitting the coronavirus.
And so within this group, we have people from different racial and ethnic minority groups, including those from our tribal communities. We have individuals who may be incarcerated or detained, people who may be homeless or living in shelters, and it may include also students living on college's campuses.
The current timeline for the state's distribution plan is based on a vaccine becoming available in December. Legalizing marijuana for adult use in Texas could generate more than $500 million per year in state tax revenue, according to a new analysis. Vicente Sederberg, a top cannabis policy and legal firm, estimates a regulated market in Texas could sustain about 1,000 cultivators and 1,000 retail stores. The firm's Sean Hauser says that would create 20 to 40,000 jobs, among other benefits.
We've estimated that if Texas stopped arresting and prosecuting individuals for, you know, misdemeanor cannabis offenses, it would save an estimated $300 million per year in criminal justice costs.
The study estimates nearly 8% of Texans 21 or older consume cannabis on a monthly basis. I'm Joseph Leahy for the Texas Standard.
Support for these Texas headlines comes from the University of Texas at Dallas, where nearly 30,000 students strive for academic rigor, career focus, and social opportunities. More at utdallas.edu/bright. UT Dallas, moving at the speed of bright.
33 minutes past the hour, Texas Standard Time. I'm David Brown. Many folks have heard of the Great Migration of the early 20th century, which marked the movement of roughly 6 million African Americans from the South to the North seeking a better life. But not all black Texans headed that far north. Some migrated from rural areas to big cities in Texas, like Houston. And as historians have pointed out, business-friendly Houston wasn't always so friendly for their black communities. Erin Douglas is a business reporter for the Houston Chronicle, where she recently wrote about this issue, and she joins us now. Erin, thanks for speaking with us on The Standard.
I really appreciate you having me.
A lot of what you're writing about is history, essentially.
Yes.
I'm wondering what it was about Houston's business history that drew you to talk about this story.
Well, you know, back before the pandemic, back when we used to have business conferences in Houston, you were always sort of hearing this romantic language around the free market economy, the free enterprise in Houston, the idea that markets, if left to their own devices, would work. And really, it's an American narrative, I think, that we hear all the time. But in particular, in Houston, loves it with the legacy of Spindletop and Wildcatters. It really gets a lot of play here. So for this section, which my business colleagues decided to put together after we did some initial coverage of the Buy Black movement this summer, I really wanted to take another look at that and see if that narrative really held up for black communities. And ultimately, as historians told me, it really does not. Oftentimes, the market failed when it came to black businesses and communities.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that narrative. In recent years, Houston has touted its diversity, the most multicultural city in Texas. Back in the 60s, there was a version of this, too, when unrest was roiling other major cities across the country. Houston's leaders tried to take credit for a relative calm, you know, as a result of better race relations. They sort of tied it to the lack of zoning regulations, encouraging more interaction between people from different backgrounds. How accurate is that story?
Yeah. The lack of zoning is an interesting thing because Houston doesn't have zoning as we maybe you've heard of that. Maybe we all know that. But there are other ways that Houston regulates its land use. Historically, there were deed restrictions or ordinances. And oftentimes those deed restrictions, as Bill Fulton of Rice University's Kinder Institute for Urban Research told me, oftentimes those deed restrictions explicitly excluded racial groups from neighborhoods, meaning that, you know, black families were not allowed to move into certain areas or their neighborhoods were valued less than white communities who had been zoned, or not zoned, but in effect zoned a certain way.
Well, let's talk about how the sort of business climate for black Houstonians trying to break out, because, as you say, there was this narrative that Houston is open for business no matter what, right? That wasn't the case.
Yeah, right. And just jumping back to the Great Migration, Bernadette Pruitt, who's an associate and tenured professor of history at Sam Houston State University, who helped me a lot in the research for this article, she studied black migration, and she points out that black workers, when they arrived in Houston, from the very beginning, they were hired for more dangerous jobs. They were hired for jobs that paid less. They were hired for jobs that were grueling work at lower pay than their white peers. And middle-class black men in particular struggled to break into skilled jobs, even if they had college degrees. At times, these professionals, they faced violence when they took jobs such as firefighting and engineering. And Pruitt says this really created a form of social control to make sure that Black workers were not going to be able to accumulate wealth when they first got to Houston.
Fast forward to today, how much do you believe has changed and does it continue to change?
Well, you know, I think that the article ends on a hopeful note. As you pointed out at the beginning of our conversation, Houston is the most diverse city in America. More than 70% of folks in Harris County under the age of 20 are Black or Hispanic, and attitudes are changing in Houston. Stephen Kleinberg, who just wrote a book on this changing attitude in Houston, points out that there are some changes in attitudes towards increasing support for environmental regulations, increasing support for intervention in markets when it comes to rectifying inequities in the market. And so I think there are some hopeful signs here. At the same time, the legacy of redlining, the legacy of some of this discrimination that we've talked about has made it such that a lot of the environmental contamination that we see in Houston is pushed right up against Black and Hispanic communities. So that's definitely an area to look at now as we think about this legacy of discrimination in Houston.
This is an in-depth and eye-opening story, and we encourage you to go over to texasstandard.org, where we'll link to Erin Douglas's piece. She's business reporter for the Houston Chronicle. Erin, thanks again.
Thanks so much.
Support for Texas Standard comes from Raise Your Hand Texas, presenting the Intersect Ed podcast, where the stories of Texas public education policy and practice meet. Available at raiseyourhandtexas.org/podcast and most podcast platforms.
My name is Michelle Reinhart, and I am president of Blue Action Democrats Southwest Austin. And we are doing an initiative we are calling Project Vote Safe, where we help folks stay in line by providing water, snacks, chairs if they need to sit down, and just help people in line if they have questions, folks with impaired mobility, elderly folks who maybe can't stay in line so long, they help them get to the front. And this is the first year we're doing it. In 2018, what we saw, especially on Election Day, were really long lines. People were excited to vote. You know, what do you want when you're waiting in line, right? You might get thirsty, so you want water. You might get hungry, so snacks, something shelf-stable that is not a big deal to deal with. And then sometimes you just get tired of standing, or you can't stand, or maybe you've recently had surgery, or you're just older or something, and it's just hard to stand for that long. And so we had bought a bunch of chairs for meetings that we can't have in person anymore, so we're repurposing those. And a lot of this on-the-ground effort came from our volunteers, and they came up with a system of having water ready in a wagon with snacks and hand sanitizer and gloves and masks. And we just ask people, hey, do you need anything? Are you okay? Voting is important no matter who you're gonna vote for. We're a pro-voting club. My name is Michelle Reinhart, and I'm a volunteer passing out water, snacks, and chairs in a very long line of voters in Austin, Texas. You're listening to the Texas Standard.
As the countdown to Election Day continues, so does our focus on Latino voters. On the show, we've had conversations about the history of the Latino vote and Hispanic Republicans. It's a population many say could tip an election if they turned out in large numbers. The proverbial sleeping giant, perhaps you've heard of that. But there's a giant problem with that metaphor. As Cecilia Bailly writes in her story for Texas Monthly, Latinos are by and large informed, independent political thinkers whom our political system hasn't properly understood or engaged. Cecilia, welcome to the Texas Standard.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
I think when I first heard that maybe we shouldn't be calling this political cohort a sleeping giant, I wondered, well, is it because people are sensitive to the use of that term? But it seems as if you're making a slightly different argument. You're saying that actually politics and democracy more generally is not served well by this term.
I feel that it's a misleading term that doesn't capture the reasons, the true deeper reasons behind some of the political disengagement by Latinos. The metaphor suggests that people are sleeping, meaning they're disengaged or they're not paying attention. And then that it's this giant that's going to wake up, you know, it's a supposition. And this will happen when it's the right candidate or the right election. And that's where we end up having these narratives before the elections. This is the election where Latinos are going to turn out in much larger numbers. And Latinos have been turning out in larger numbers. But the turnout doesn't end up meeting those expectations oftentimes. And so we were looking for the deeper reasons.
Tell us a little bit about what you found when you went looking. You were out on the road all over Texas for something like a year talking with Latino voters?
The interviews took place across 5 months. We spent a month in each of the major areas, and then we spent quite a bit of time reviewing 3,000 pages of transcripts to find the most salient themes. And on the issue of non-voters, which is just one segment of the study, you know, the common idea is that Latino non-voters are apathetic and they don't care, and that's why they don't vote. Even Latinos, I'm Latina, and even my Latino peers will say that. They'll say our people don't care. What we found was that most non-voters were following political news to some degree, some of them quite closely, but they didn't feel that their vote mattered. They had a harder time connecting government to their life. And they just felt like they didn't put it in these words, but, you know, this is something that other people have been doing. And for different reasons, they felt like their own vote was not going to carry any weight. And so they were following politics, but they're following from the sidelines.
Something that was striking to me about the article that you did for Texas Monthly was that when you come from a family where your father and your mother didn't cast ballots and you don't really have any history of it, this can have a profound impact on your perception of political activity.
Absolutely. I think that's another key finding in the study, is that voting really is a social habit that you develop by watching someone do it. And then you practice it over time, where eventually you feel guilty if it's election day and you're in your home and you haven't gone out to vote. And this is something that not just in Latino families, but any non-voting families, the children who don't grow up seeing this will have to find a different pathway to become voters. The surest voters, it seemed, are the ones that grew up with parents doing it regularly. We even interviewed somebody who had been involved in political campaigns as a volunteer, and she was not voting. So that tells you that voting is not simply a rational decision where people sit down and say, this is good for me, it's going to make my life better. It also involves this sort of inner conviction and habit of feeling like it's something you have to do, it's something that you do regularly, and if you don't do it, something's off.
Something else that sort of went against some of the stereotypes was the idea that that Latinos who leaned Republican often did so because of maybe social or religious values. Well, something stood out in your findings that some Republican Latinos who voiced concern over limited government resources were also thinking about what this meant for their own bottom lines.
Yes, we found that that was a more prevalent theme. I mean, certainly some Latinos vote Republican because of their religious and social views. But really on the issue of abortion, for instance, you know, we found that it was mostly folks who were evangelical, for example, that had a harder stance on that issue. And others were more flexible, like abortion wouldn't be the ultimate determining factor, how they voted. But what was common with every Republican we interviewed was just that view of government, that government should not be playing such a big role, a sense of more limited resources, the idea that we don't have enough to provide support for everybody, you know, and that emphasis on sort of pulling yourself up by your own bootstraps, you know. But I should say that Latinos across the board, even Democrats and independents, they have a very strong emphasis on the work ethic. They tend to take a lot of pride in personal effort and work. But with Republicans, they just have a sense that the government should not be providing so much help.
Part of the mainstream narrative is that Democrats do a better job of reaching out to Latino voters. I wonder, as you think historically speaking, how do the parties actually do when it comes to outreach to Latino voters?
Neither party has done a good job of reaching out to Latinos and engaging them consistently, and not just at election time, and engaging them on other issues beyond immigration. And so what you see is that Latinos don't speak in highly ideological terms, and a number of them are independent. A great number of them consider themselves independent, even if they consistently vote for one or another party. And I think that partly reflects that lack of conversation.
Cecilia Bailly is a writer for Texas Monthly, and her latest is titled Don't Call Texas's Latino Voters the Sleeping Giant. We'll have a link to it at texasstandard.org. Cecilia, thanks for speaking with us.
I appreciate it.
Support for Texas Standard comes from the Texas Tuition Promise Fund. For over 10 years, helping families lock in current tuition rates and required fees at Texas public colleges and universities, excluding medical and dental institutions. TexasTuitionPromiseFund.com.
It's the Texas Standard. I'm David Brown. The presidential election is just weeks away, and one group paying close attention, asylum seekers living in Mexico, waiting for their day in U.S. immigration court. Since 2019, under a policy known as Remain in Mexico, the Trump administration has sent tens of thousands of asylum seekers back across the border. The government says this helps filter out fraudulent asylum claims. The U.S. Supreme Court just this week agreed to take up a challenge to that policy. From the start, advocates slammed the policy, calling it a violation of due process, one that put people in grave danger. Then came the coronavirus. Now, COVID-19's put asylum hearings on hold, postponed indefinitely, and migrants are stuck in legal limbo. Today, we begin a week-long look at the issue in the asylum trap. We'll hear from asylum seekers in Ciudad Juarez, just across the border from El Paso, closely watching to see what'll happen on November 3rd. To get us started, KERA's Mallory Falk introduces us to a family that's been stuck in this position for over a year. And a quick note to listeners, we're not using their full names since they're still in immigration proceedings.
It's a sweltering late summer afternoon at the Ponda Vida Migrant Shelter. Cesar and Carolina, a married couple from Nicaragua, cook lunch in the kitchen they share with several other families. The shelter is made up of several small yellow houses arranged in a circle around a dusty courtyard. Cesar sprinkles onions over a steaming pan of rice. Carolina stirs a pot of beans. There's a flurry of activity around them. Children race in and out. One of their housemates, the shelter's unofficial beautician, sits nearby painting another resident's nails. Cesar's making a dish called carne enchorizada. It's a welcome taste of home for his 9-year-old son, Donovan, who hasn't quite acclimated to the level of spice in Mexican food.
Me siento así, que no puedo aguantar el chile que está en mi boca.
I feel like I can't take the chili that's in my mouth, Donovan says, fanning his tongue like it's on fire. Because of a policy officially known as the Migrant Protection Protocols, or MPP, Cesar says the family's been in Juarez for 15 months.
I don't understand this MPP, Migrant Protection. What is the protection we have? They send you back onto the streets as if you were trash, an empty milk carton. Even children, they even throw out children with their mothers.
This isn't what they expected when they fled Nicaragua last year. Cesar drove a taxi. When the government proposed cutting Social Security, taxi drivers led popular protests. The government cracked down, violently. Paramilitary forces intimidated and attacked protesters. At least 300 people were killed. President Trump condemned the Nicaraguan regime's actions. Cesar tells me he was attacked twice while driving his taxi, once while his wife and son were in the car. When forces started circling his house, trying to break in, he knew his family had to leave. He was relieved when they reached the U.S. border.
We saw the officers in green and we felt protected. For the first time since we started facing this problem, we felt protected.
But it didn't go how they hoped. The family passed an initial asylum screening and were given paperwork with a hearing date. But then, Carolina says,
They returned us to Ciudad Juarez. We're in a country we don't know.
A place they don't feel safe. In May, a human rights group found more than 1,000 reported cases of violence against migrants in MPP, including torture, rape, and murder. Cesar leaves the shelter for work, but Carolina and Donovan, they've been mostly shut in. Donovan entertains himself playing with a trompo or top. He likes to make it spin, then scoop it up in his hand. His parents try to shield him from the full reality of their situation.
We never instill anything negative in him. We tell him that we're traveling around like tourists, getting to know new people and places.
When Donovan asks why they're spending so long here, why they don't leave and see other sites, I tell him it takes time, Cesar says. Many at this shelter are still waiting for asylum hearings, but Cesar and Carolina already received a decision. They were not granted asylum. In fact, less than 5% of migrants who've completed their MPP cases got protection in the U.S. Now they're appealing that decision and looking to the presidential election.
Our hope is there will be some change that benefits all of us here.
Carolina says if Trump's reelected, there's likely no chance her family will get into the country. But she and Cesar, they haven't even let themselves think about that. Cesar says they still have to hold on to some hope of crossing the border.
There are people who come to the U.S. seeking the American dream. We didn't flee because we wanted to. We didn't leave behind our life in Nicaragua, leave our parents, our nieces and nephews, our friends, because we wanted to. We were forced to leave our country.
All they're asking, he says, is for safety, something that feels even more critical since they learned Carolina's pregnant with their second child. They say they don't want their baby growing up in a dismal, gray atmosphere. They want brightness for their children. I'm Mallory Falk in Ciudad Juarez.
And you are listening to the Texas Standard. Wells Dunbar is our social media editor, and he's monitoring the talk of Texas once again on this Tuesday. Hello there, Wells.
Hello, David. Well, an appeals court ruling shortly after we went off the air yesterday has social media buzz. I'm sure you've heard about this one. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that Texas can reject absentee ballots if they think the signatures don't match the voter's signature on file, as is law. But moreover, election officials are not required to inform voters that their ballot has been rejected. There's the crux of the outrage, I guess you could say, on social media. The Texas Tribune reports this development overruled a lower court ruling that sought to halt the signature verification process or set up a system to inform voters that their ballot was invalidated. The Tribune also notes, as reported elsewhere, that the state has no statewide standards or training credentials for signature verification. So obviously lots of folks talking about this one. On our Facebook page, Laura Cohen writes that it's terrible to think your vote would not be counted. She adds that her mom hand-delivered a mail-in ballot a few days ago, then emailed to confirm that it was accepted, and notes that she was fortunate as it was early enough that she could still go in if it had been rejected in part. Other people noting some other interesting aspects of it, such as Sin Huddleston, who writes, what part of disabled are they having trouble with, Sin writing that they have rheumatoid arthritis and that signatures often vary from, day to day. Personally, I have a pretty messy signature myself, so we're seeing that reflected from other commenters as well, noting that
Something that strikes me about this debate, mm-hmm. I was reading several stories about this, signature verification and that kind of thing. And that is, it's often mentioned that when it comes to voter fraud, there really isn't a whole lot of evidence of voter fraud in the state of Texas. One question that I have, and maybe listeners know about this, how often is it that absentee ballots are rejected on the basis of signatures? I don't know how much of a problem it is, but clearly a lot of people very concerned that their votes might be rejected because of signature analysis at some point. I would be interested in knowing what the statistics are, if those statistics are available, where one might find us.
Yeah, I would too. And again, I would point to some of the other reporting surrounding this that's been really interesting. I believe the New York Times had an interactive on their website where they actually presented six identical signatures and asked readers to pick out the one that was fraudulent. So obviously, again, without that specialized training, it's an interesting wrinkle of our election law that is getting highlighted by this election. Well, speaking of the election, just eyeing the headlines here, I see an interesting one here in Politico about Joe Biden. Biden eyes GOP candidates for cabinet slots, I believe, including former Ohio Governor John Kasich, who spoke there at the Democratic National Committee, being one of those names floated around for a potential Biden cabinet. Yeah, very interesting stuff indeed.
We're out of time for the big broadcast. We'll be back here tomorrow, and we hope you can join us.
Philanthropic support for Texas Standard comes from Casey and Scott O'Hare, the Winkler Family Foundation, Lynn Dobson and Greg Woldridge, Adrian Killam, and the George Huntington Family.